super friends. My name is Neil, and welcome to this episode 110 of the Get Your Comic Con podcast. We're here fortnightly-ish to bring you a slice of film, TV, and pop culture goodness from our studio, direct to your listening device, and also to your screen. Yes, after easing myself back in from a long break with the last episode, I am back on YouTube, recording myself, trying to fumble my way through this podcast. So if you'd like to tune in, then you can also watch this episode on YouTube or wherever you get your video podcasts. This episode, we're going to be diving into our newly interactive news section by talking about not one, but two trailers that have released very recently, as well as catching you up on a couple of interviews that we've done here at Geico Tower in the last couple of weeks. And then for reviews, I'm going to be talking about a vampire movie and something which is the polar opposite, which is a very kid-friendly TV series. So without further ado, let's dive into the news. First up in the news this week, we got to see the first trailer, a very, very, very teasery trailer, might add, for Joker Folie à Deux, once again directed by Todd Phillips. The film brings back Joaquin Phoenix as Arthur Fleck slash the Joker. It also returns star Zazie Beetz, who played Sophie, the next-door neighbour in the first film, and a couple of other returning actors from the first film from 2019, as well as new actors Catherine Keener, Brendan Gleeson, Steve Coogan, and as you're all going, why haven't you mentioned her? We also get the debut of Lady Gaga, who will be playing a brand new version of Harley Quinn. Folie à Deux is coming to UK cinemas in October 2024, so we have a few months to wait. But for now, we do have our very, very first look at the film with this teaser trailer. Now, we don't know very much about Folie à Deux. All we know, that title refers to The Madness of Two, which is no doubt why Harley Quinn is now in the film. We don't even have a synopsis yet, so we can only go off what we see in this trailer, which it would seem that this version of Harley Quinn is going to be an inmate at Arkham State Mental Institution, which is where Arthur has been housed following the events of the first film. It certainly looks like at some point in this film he's going to be on trial. It seems like the two of them are going to connect whilst they're both inmates within Arkham, and that they will venture into this sort of doomed mad love situation that will culminate in them probably burning the world down. And of course, the other major factor that we know about Folie à Deux is that it is going to be a musical of some description. Now, Todd Phillips has said very carefully that he wouldn't describe it as a musical, that he feels it is a musical in a similar respect to how the first film was a musical. Now, if you go back to any interviews from around that time, Phillips talked about Arthur Fleck as having music within him, and that kind of came from some of Joaquin Phoenix's movements, but also came out from a sequence that was decided upon on the day when they were shooting in the bathroom for the sequence after Arthur has killed the three Wayne Enterprise employees. That was originally set to be a scene of him hiding the gun, but became something very musical, particularly, I think, based on what music they were hearing from Hilda Granadottir's score, which will obviously play a huge part in the second film. But yes, there is more musical elements in the second film, which will include, no doubt, because you have Lady Gaga playing Harley Quinn, some cat has decided to join us. So if you're watching on YouTube, hello from Oliver. Obviously, she is a musician by background as well as an actress, and so you naturally would want to make the most of her skills. So expect some singing and dancing from both Joaquin Phoenix and Harley Quinn in this film, although we don't know what songs there might be yet. We don't know if there'll be any originals or whether it will purely be a jukebox musical, but certainly this teaser trailer is hinting at aspects of that. There is some very, very cool... Thanks for whipping me in the face with your tail. There's some very, very cool classic Hollywood set design work going on in this teaser, which is something, again, that they have talked about very briefly, because this film has really not been talked about all that much yet. But in terms of how the film has been produced, some very classic set design. So there is a beautiful sequence in this trailer where they're dancing on a rooftop, and it's styled like a... It's almost like La La Land in a way. It's styled with a very classic Hollywood backdrop. It's now Hotel Arkham, and it's this luscious rooftop with the starry sky and the beautiful signage in the background that looks very painted and very handmade. So it's going to be interesting to see how that factors in. If you're asking me, which you did on social media, then yes, I think that the musical sequences will be the kind of mania between the two of them, and the situation that the two catch each other up in. So almost like shared delusions in a way that this, there. I keep calling it Mad Love, which, for people who don't know, was the name of a very famous episode of Batman the Animated Series, which dove back into the origin of Harley Quinn and her relationship with the Joker, and then became a very, very successful comic book, also written by Bruce Timm as well. So I think this is Todd Phillips and Joaquin Phoenix's version of exploring the relationship between the two of them, is these kind of, it's the way the two of them see the world. And his way was obviously very romantic in the first film, you know, the relationship that he imagined with Sophie, the next door neighbor. But now, if we're catching some of that from Harley Quinn's angle, it's going to be this musical, rosy, lovely relationship between the two of them that probably won't exist in person if it's anything like classic representations of both of these characters. But what remains to be seen is exactly how Harley Quinn will be characterized. We hear a little bit of her voice in the teaser, but not all that much. It does seem that they're stepping away from her being someone who works at Arkham to being an inmate, so that will be interesting to see. And perhaps it's probably more fitting for this version of the world. I don't feel like Joaquin Phoenix's Arthur is quite manipulative enough that he would be able to take someone like a psychiatrist or psychologist kind of figure that was working with him and manipulate them and bring them down to his level. So it makes more sense to me in this world that she's an inmate who gets swept up in the romantic world of Arthur and who he is. I asked you for some of your thoughts on this teaser, and you did not disappoint. You got in touch on both Instagram and on Twitter. It seems like there's a lot of love out there for this film. I think a few of you are definitely unsure about Harley Quinn, and sorry, I just answered a bunch of your questions by touching on it there. But yeah, I think they're going to step away from the classic portrayal to do something that fits more with the world of 2019's Joker and the world that Todd Phillips has created around Joaquin Phoenix. And you're definitely like me, a lot of you out there are skeptical about the musical elements. So let's see how they work. I think if they are merely fantasy sequences, then it will be a cool way to visualize how these two see each other. So that's going to be interesting. If some of that musicality comes into the real world, then it will be, I'm going to have to do air quotes for those of you watching on YouTube because I don't believe it's real. Then it will be interesting to see how that potentially recontextualizes the film. So let's wait and see, shall we? It comes to UK cinemas on October the 4th, 2024. So a little bit longer to wait. We're currently in April, so we have a few months to wait. I would expect a full trailer probably in summer, maybe at San Diego Comic-Con if we're lucky. If not, it'll probably be a little bit later. The first film is very much following the pattern of releases for the first film. So we got the poster around the same. The release date is basically the same as it was in 2019. So the first poster and the first trailer both lined up with when we got those for the first film. So I would genuinely not expect to see anything more until until August time. Definitely October. We'll see the full film in October. So that's Joker Folie à Deux. If you do want to reach out, let me know your thoughts, then please do on social media. You can find me at Neil Vag on all major platforms. I always like to hear what you think about the things that I'm talking about. So the first interview I want to talk to you about is for a recently released Star Wars book called Star Wars: The Living Force, which is available now in all good bookstores and is written by the lovely John Jackson Miller, who is a New York Times bestselling author. He won a Scribe Award for Star Wars Kenobi, which was released in 2013, and believe it or not, that was his last full Star Wars book. He has done some short stories in the meantime. He is also known for writing Star Wars: A New Dawn, Lost Tribe of the Sith, Knight Errant, and Star Wars Legends: The Old Republic graphic novel. So James sat down with John to talk about Star Wars: The Living Force, and I'm going to play you a little snippet right now.
In very interesting, and you kind of mentioned certain types of fans in relation to eras, and you know, the prequel era was, you know, that was where I grew up. That was all I was digesting when I was a kid, still am. And what is it about the prequel era, you know, from Phantom Menace to Revenge of the Sith, that is so inviting for these sort of new stories? I mean, I never would have imagined we would get a book like this focusing purely on individual members of the council. I really didn't think that would be a thing. But here we are. It's
It is something that, it obviously it came up because of the 25th anniversary. I think it was something that I particularly was suited to do because I have done all these novels with the particularly the Star Trek novels that I've done, which have very large casts. And so I've been able to manipulate that sort of thing. But the prequel era, which, and this is the first book I've done in the prequel era has themes that are just not present in some of the other parts of the timeline. I mean, this is a period of decay. It is a slow moving car accident that we were watching here. There is it's a case where the reader is aware of more than the Jedi are. I kind of played with that when I wrote my Knights of the Old Republic comics because the readers were aware of what was going to happen later in the Knights of the Old Republic video game, but they weren't entirely sure how my comics connected to them. And was anybody in my cast a major character in the comics or in the game or not? Some were, some weren't. Well, here is a case where everybody knows who Darth Vader is and everybody knows who the Emperor is. But we have to tell these stories with everybody else being in the dark. But they're able to figure out some things. We just get to tell these stories of these missed connections where if they only had checked into this one thing or this other thing or whatever, they might have seen what was going on. But we also come up with very good reasons why they might not have. And that is part of the fun and challenge of writing in this era.
As I said, you can check out that full interview over on our YouTube channel. Just head over to YouTube and type in Get Your Comic Con, or you can head over to our website, which is www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk, and just search Star Wars, head over to the interview section, and you can check out the interview in full. We will also be releasing an audio version in an upcoming podcast very, very soon. So now I want to talk to you about another trailer. This one is very, very fresh. This one literally just released last night as I am recording this podcast. And that is a new full trailer for Marvel Studios' Deadpool and Wolverine. This one is coming to UK cinemas on July the 25th. So the release date has moved up in the UK by 24 hours and it's releasing in the US on my birthday, July the 26th. I just so happen to be in the US on my birthday at San Diego Comic-Con, so I'm going to be checking it out on my birthday, all being well. But Marvel Studios has finally revealed a full look at Hugh Jackman's return as Wolverine, and I am here for it. I am here for it. If you have not checked out the full trailer, then obviously you can watch it over on our website. But I'm going to give you just a few of my thoughts on this film and answer a couple of questions that you guys have sent in. Thank you on social media for getting in touch about Deadpool and Wolverine. First of all, let's just do the particulars for this one. It's directed by Shawn Levy and written by Levy alongside Ryan Reynolds and Rhett Reese, as well as starring Reynolds and the returning Hugh Jackman. There are, and I'm going to try and do this carefully because there was lots of rumors as well as some potential spoilers that think they've been confirmed. So let's just, this is the supposed cast list as best as I'm going to interpret it. Emma Corrin is playing Cassandra Nova, who we get our first look at in this trailer. Marina Baccarin returns as Vanessa, Rob Delaney, Karen Soney, Leslie Uggams, Matthew McFadden, Jennifer Garner, Josh Brolin, rumored to play Cable, Kelly Hu, who we get a glimpse of in this trailer as Yuriko slash Deathstrike. We've also got Brianna Hildebrand, who returns as Negasonic Teenage Warhead. Rumored Patrick Stewart, Shaoli Kutsuna, Jason Fleming, Aaron Stanford, Lewis Tan, Stefan Kapicic, as Kapicic, sorry, I just really Britishized that. And I think we'll stop there. We again don't have a synopsis. This is the second trailer I'm covering today that we don't have a synopsis for. But from what we can gather in this new trailer, it seems that something is wiping out various Earths within the Marvel multiverse, and that Deadpool is tasked by Loki's TVA to try and stop it. And in order to do that, he needs to team up with a version of, and that's something we will touch on in a second, Hugh Jackman's Wolverine to help save the day. So there is, I mean, you don't need me to tell you because obviously you're watching this or listening to this, which means you're already interested in the subject matter, but there is plenty out there on the internet about this film and who might be in it, who isn't in it, who was asked to be in it, what might be happening. Going to take a swig of tea. And so without A, having seen it, thanks very much, Marvel, because, you know, it's out in like 3 months, or having an official synopsis, it's difficult to be able to talk about what might be going on. But we can definitely surmise a few things from this trailer. So we know that Deadpool is very much still existing in his usual space in the universe, the multiverse, at the beginning of this film, when he appears to be called in by the TVA, which is something we saw more of in the first trailer than this one, and introduced to the idea of the MCU and the sacred timeline. We have seen Matthew McFadden's TVA character showing him footage of the Avengers. So we know that that's how he is introduced to them before he refers to himself as Marvel Jesus. And that that has something to do with the end of the Fox universe and the kind of melding of all these timelines together and how people will fit where they're going to fit moving forwards in the future. So, what might that mean? It certainly seems from this trailer like the version of Wolverine that we're being introduced to is an outcast on his Earth. He is referred to by McFadden as having failed all of the mutants on his Earth. So it would seem that something that has happened that has caused him to be one of the only mutants left, which may or may not be tied to Cassandra Nova, and that he then has basically no choice but to team up with Deadpool to help him try and save either his loved ones or his Earth from being destroyed. Now, I don't think that what we're saying this film is going to do is that it's going to save the Fox universe. What it maybe is going to do is save certain aspects of that universe that Marvel is happy to keep intact, at least for now, to give them their own pocket corner of the Marvel overarching multiverse, as it were, so that they can kind of exist fondly in people's memory without being wiped out or overwritten or anything like that. Because there are obviously lots of aspects of what Fox did movie-wise that people enjoyed. The X-Men franchise, for all of its dud films, has some amazing moments and has birthed some amazing characters. Hugh Jackman has been playing this role for nearly a quarter of a century, and that's not because people didn't like him, that's because people loved him. And, you know, we wouldn't have the Deadpool movies if it wasn't for what was done with the original X-Men back in 2002. So there is, you know, there's love out there, and people have, there are cult audiences for films like Daredevil. There are people, like me, who love Jennifer Garner as Elektra, and so what they're doing is very carefully looking at what aspects of this universe they can poke fun at, what can they keep, what can they play around with here, as the Fox universe is put in danger by something out there in the wider world, be that Cassandra Nova or not. Now, for those of you who don't know who Cassandra Nova is, she's being played by Emma Corrin from The Crown in this film. Cassandra Nova is a twin of Charles Xavier, who was believed to have been kind of absorbed and eaten and killed in the womb. Dark, I know. Only she has similar powers to him and has an evil vendetta because she is not who Charles is. So she is equally bald and beautiful, much like the wonderful Patrick Stewart. And as you can see from this trailer, is very much not happy with Wolverine or friendly with him. Swigging my tea. But what we don't know for now is exactly what her motivations are, exactly whether she is the villain of the piece or just a villain who will appear in it. Lots more to pick up on, though, that is in this trailer that's very exciting. Firstly, so many F-bombs. Clearly Ryan Reynolds and Hugh Jackman were having a lot of fun making this film. But let's talk about cameos for a second. There are some obvious ones and some less obvious ones. Now, we saw Pyro, played by Aaron Stanford, in the last trailer. He is glimpsed again very briefly in the corner of a shot in this trailer that features a bunch of other characters, including what's now confirmed to be Kelly Hu as Yuriko / Lady Deathstrike from X2. She appears alongside Azazel. Now, whether Azazel will be played by the same actor from First Contact, that's a Star Trek movie, from X-Men First Class or not, remains to be seen. But Azazel appears to be there, as does Toad, as does potentially, Toad from X-Men 1, Callisto, who could be from The Last Stand. There's a bunch of different X-Men characters who are in that shot. And you can be forgiven for not spotting them because they are all placed in front of Giant Man, aka Ant-Man in big form, whose helmet is very clearly seen in the shot and who is a skull inside it. So there's a whole subplot there to do with a version of Ant-Man being caught in this weird universe between universes, where it's this desert Mad Max type land, which I'm sure is going to be a joke given some of the shots in the trailer, where all these characters are converging in the world between worlds. So there is a lot that we need to try and unpick there. There are some other shots from inside the body of this Ant-Man. There is a shot towards the end of the trailer where Deadpool and Wolverine jump through a portal. It's very Endgame Doctor Strange style. We don't see where they're going, but we see them jumping into it. So there's a chance there that we might see some kind of connection to... I said this to a couple of people online, but if you ask me, I think what's happening is they probably think they're jumping into a version of the fight from Endgame, and they'll land in the kind of wasteland outside Avengers Tower as there's a cleanup and there's no actual heroes there. What I think is important to also note is that there are no MCU characters in this trailer. So we don't see anyone from the MCU interacting with Deadpool. So we're either hiding a lot, I mean, we're hiding plenty of other things from the Fox universe, but we're not seeing a full Deadpool in the MCU scenario here. It almost seems like this film might bridge the gap between the two, so it'll be interesting to see where he ends up. I think I have probably said enough about this trailer, because otherwise I'm going to start going into really wild territory of theories and ideas that we could be here all day. What I think is amazing is we are two trailers into this. It's out in around 3 months' time, and we still don't, as I said, we don't have a synopsis, but we also don't have a clear indication as to the story or exactly what's happening, which is very, very exciting. I think what we're seeing from the two trailers that we've talked about on this podcast is two studios not wanting to give away everything straight away, which is very exciting. We're not giving away all of our cards. We're not giving away exactly what's happening. We're not giving away everyone who's appearing in either of these films. We're really trying to go back to an era where trailers were tantalizing and teasing you for what the final film should be. And I don't think that's because either of these films are trying to figure out what they are in the edit. I think that's because we are genuinely not wanting to give everything away, which is really, really exciting. So that is Deadpool and Wolverine, which is in UK cinemas on July the 25th and in US cinemas from July the 26th. Watch for loads more from that. We're pitching to try and do as much as we possibly can to cover it. Likewise, if it has a presence at San Diego Comic-Con, I'm going to be there and I'll be bringing you as much as physically possible, including my reaction when I finally get to watch it. And that leads me into another James moment, which is another really cool interview that he has done recently. And in fact, leads us into a review that we'll be doing once we get out of this new section. So, brand new series which is coming to Paramount Plus this Saturday in the UK, which is April the 27th. It will premiere in the US on April the 26th, is Knuckles, a Sonic series. It's a spin-off from the two recent Paramount Sonic movies. It's a 6-episode limited series which stars Adam Pally as Wade Whipple, not Wade Wilson, to be confused with Deadpool, and Idris Elba as Knuckles. It's a cool little adventure series which sees the two of them going off on their own little adventure as Sonic is busy doing his Sonic-y thing, and is set between Sonic 2, which came out last year, and Sonic 3, which is out a little later this year, and is it's really fun, but we're going to talk about that in a second. First of all, I want to play you an excerpt from a brand new interview which just dropped yesterday as this podcast is dropping, where James sat down with lead live-action actor Adam Pally to talk about his role as Wade Whipple. So check out a little bit of what the two of them had to say.
Looking back at your role in the first Sonic movie and even the second movie, did you anticipate that your character would kind of go on this journey?
No. I mean, I think it's an actor's dream, you know, in a lot of ways. It's like you get a small part and you're so excited to be in a small part of a big thing, and then they give you a little more to do in the next one, and you're a little bit of a bigger part in a bigger thing, and then the next thing you know, you're like, they've given you this huge responsibility that, you know, I think every actor would relish. So I didn't expect this at all, but I'm happy and glad that it came when it did, because I feel like I was like a good timing for myself to like lead a series like this, you know.
Thanks again to Paramount Plus for inviting us to the junket, and also to the premiere for Knuckles as well. Actually, it was really, really good fun. You can read James's full review over on our website now, and I'll be bringing you my thoughts in just a second. But for now, if you want to see that full interview between James and Adam Pally, head over to our website, www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk, or just search us on YouTube, Get Your Comic-Con, and you can see the full interview over there. Make sure while you're there to like and subscribe as well. In fact, like and subscribe this video if you're watching us on YouTube, or just make sure to subscribe to our podcast wherever you're wherever you are listening to us, because I have lost the power of speech. That's it for the news in this episode. I will once again be putting out a call on social media for any topics you want me to discuss in the next episode, or for you to give us any of your comments on some of the top stories that we're going to be discussing. So as always, if you want to get involved, please find us on social media. We are at Get Your Comic Con on all major platforms, and get involved. For now, on to our reviews. So the first thing that I want to review for this podcast is a brand new film from Universal, which is in UK cinemas now. See if you can figure out what it is. It's directed by Matt Bettinelli-Alpin and Tyler Gillett, better known as Radio Silence, and written by Stephen Shields and Guy Bissick. Have you got it yet? It stars Alicia Weir as the title character. It also stars Melissa Barrera, Dan Stevens, William Cartlett, Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, Angus Cloud, Giancarlo Esposito, and Matthew Good. Got it yet? I want to talk to you. I've got really itchy notes. Apologies for those of you who are watching this. I've got like cat hair and allergies. So I want to talk to you about Abigail, which is a horror movie that I have absolutely adored watching and I'm desperate to see again, which is in UK cinemas now. Short synopsis is: a group of criminals kidnap the ballerina daughter of a powerful underworld figure. They retreat to an isolated mansion, unaware that they're locked inside with no normal little girl. I have written a full review of this, which you can also check out over on our website. I'm really sadly, I did not preload it, so I'm now just loading it up in the background so that I can remind myself of exactly what I said. But I know I gave it 4 stars. You should always be prepared for a podcast, and also funny that I'm laughing when there's no one here for me to talk to. So in my review over on the website, I said Abigail is deliciously blood-soaked. From its cool cast to its fiendishly explosive gore, the film is a fun experiment with the vampire genre for an audience getting to break with tradition. Now, it's very, very interesting, because if you have I should probably say spoiler alert, I'm going to go into some minor spoilers here. So if you have seen a trailer for this film, or if you've seen even the poster for this trailer, then you know that there's more to Abigail than meets the eye. In fact, if you've seen the trailer, you know she's a vampire outright, because it's just there. It's discussed. It's also in publicity clips. If you look at posters, then yes, the fangs are there. So it's not hard to figure out what's going on. But interestingly, the film doesn't jump straight to it. There is a kind of heist movie within the vampire movie that you need to kind of get through before you get to the whole vampire-iness of it. The first act very much sets up this group of, I don't want to call them mercenaries, this group of criminals who are tasked with kidnapping this young girl who they think is just being ransomed to a very, very rich underworld boss, who is her father, played by Matthew Good. But then eventually you realise that there's more to her than meets the eye, and it becomes an absolute vampire gore fest. But the film does not rush to tell you that she is a vampire, which is really interesting given that the marketing does so. And it's one way that I think that some audiences might be a little bit frustrated by Abigail, where those who've not really looked at the marketing materials might be pleasantly surprised. So if you've just seen a poster and think this is something kind of random and cool, or you've just heard that it's cool and you go in and see it, then there's this interesting setup, meeting these group of characters, seeing them kidnap this little girl, getting to understand who they are and why they're in this situation, and seeing them second guess who each other is, because there's a kind of subplot there where they're not supposed to talk to each other, so that if one of them is caught by the cops, that they can't give up who anyone else is in the group. Whereas if you were aware of who Abigail was, then there is this danger that you might be sitting there for the first half an hour or so just kind of going like, can we just kill someone and get to the blood and guts already? But actually, I thought it was really rewarding, because particularly Melissa Barrera, who you will know as from the last two Scream movies, who obviously worked with the Radio Silence guys on those, and Dan Stevens, they're both great character actors. Joey, who Joey, who is being played by Melissa Barrera, is somewhat similar to the character of Sam that she plays in the Scream movies. There is a similarity between the two of them that does exist, although there is more nuance to Sam that's really interesting to watch. Dan Stevens is just having the time of his life making this movie. It's like you can feel his excitement. It just radiates off the screen. He is clearly loving every second of being on this very cool set and watching all of this gore and horror play out around him. He's just a kid in a candy store, absolutely loving it. And so the two of them really do make watching this ensemble cast really worthwhile. Angus Cloud, to which the film is dedicated to him as he sadly passed away since making it, Catherine Newton and Kevin Durand. I look at Kevin Durand and I just see Dark Angel. I just see his character from Dark Angel, even when he doesn't have the makeup on, are also a great part of the ensemble. There's a comedy factor to each of them, where Melissa Barrera is a bit more of the straight man. Dan Stevens does have humour, but his humour almost comes from his character's swag more than kind of comedic dialogue. Everyone is just written in these really interesting ways that they all slot together very well, and they all kind of have their role to play in the story, which feels like it's very important until you realise that actually they're all just cannon fodder for the titular Abigail when she gets free and decides that she's just going to rip everyone apart. Which brings me to Alicia Weir. Now, I haven't seen Matilda. She was Matilda in the Netflix film adaptation of the current stage show that's playing here in London in the West End. So she does the whole kind of lovable orphan child type role really, really well. And people seem to really respect her and thought she did a great job in that. And then you see her in this and she is absolutely feral. She is an animal. She's lethal to the very, very bitter end. This girl has a very bright career ahead of her based on this performance alone. She is a force of nature. She screams, she dances, she flies around the set doing wire work. There is, if I'm not mistaken, it was made on around, I think I put it in my review actually, the budget is around $28 million for this film, so it's quite low-key. It has some cool practical set design, has some very, 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 very cool visceral practical gore. In fact, someone at our press screening was actually sick, sat behind. So if you have an easily upset stomach, then I do warn you about seeing this film. But it uses visual effects only to enhance some of that gore and those moments. So there is some wire work involved. Abigail is a vampire. She is able to do things that human characters can't do, and those are achieved through a great mix of practical and visual effects rather than simply just green screening or CGIing everything. There is a cool sense of practicalness to this film, which helps that impact, helps it feel more visceral, more guttural. It helps it feel more real, and it has more impact that way. We're not simply watching some kind of green screen fest. In fact, I've just seen an interview with Catherine Newton where she talked about how much easier it was to shoot Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania because she basically just had to react to nothing, whereas in this film she was running from real things, she was jumping at real things, she was, you know, it was tangible and it was real, and you can really feel that when you watch it. Obviously I get a text message that just has to ruin my flow. And you feel that throughout the whole entire film. Its setting also plays into that, because it is very much, there are almost only two locations. There's, let's say, three locations in the whole film. There is the house that they kidnap Abigail from. There is the van that they use to travel from that location to the isolated mansion where they hold her hostage, and then there is the mansion. Obviously, there are plenty of locations within that mansion, but really, we're only going from location to location to location, and it's almost like a single location episode of Star Trek or something like that, where you think, okay, we'll save on budget, we'll do this in one place, we'll have these controlled areas, and then we'll just shoot them in all these really exciting ways that will make these work. And that is very much something that Abigail does, to its credit. How do I want to describe it? I don't want to call it a lobby. The main kind of hallway, multi-level library, games room type area in the mansion where they kind of find themselves for a lot of the film is really, really beautiful to look at, and you get to see it from a bunch of different angles, and you can see how much care and attention was put into the set design, which I think is typical of the Radio Silence guys. There's a lot of care and attention put into making a film work the best that it can for the budget that it has, rather than trying to go beyond its budget and kind of stretching its means, or just doing things for the sake of it. Nothing here feels like it happens for the sake of it. Everything is for a reason that's built into the script, that's baked into the characters, and that's really, really cool to see. So I think it's so worth seeing on the big screen. That's probably all I want to say, actually. I feel I have taken him enough time. Oh, actually, no. I do want to say a little bit more. I need to say this carefully because I don't want to spoil either the ending or anything else. The film does really interestingly set up a version of New York that has an underworld that is supernatural, that has different creatures and a mythology to it that I hadn't anticipated that the film was going to set up. I thought it would just be that Abigail would be a vampire that kind of existed for the sake of existing. If you know some of the history to the film and how it develops to become the film that it is, then you might have an idea about where it's going. But none of that is explicit or even almost necessary. It's kind of a sort of epilogue that just adds a cool little kick at the end. But I actually feel like this film opens up some doors for a really interesting world of storytelling that you could do more in. For a start, it seems like there's more than just vampires out there. So what other creatures are out there? You know, are there werewolves? Are there mummies? I'm just thinking universal monsters. You know, what other things are out there that could go bump in the night that you could run into? Likewise, there's a history to Abigail and more story that you could tell with her character and her relationship with Matthew Good's character. There is more story you could tell with anyone who survives this film as well. There's some really interesting storytelling with Joey, with Dan Stevens' character, with Giancarlo Esposito's character. You could jump into any one of their character stories at different points, be it before, during, or after this film, to tell more stories with them that would be really interesting to see. So I would be very game for a sequel to Abigail, or more, you know, more storytelling in the world of Abigail. So I hope this film does well enough that they're able to do that if they feel there are stories to tell, because I certainly feel that there are. And that is a perfect place to leave it. If you want to read my full review, you can head over to our website, www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk. How many times can I say that one podcast? And you can read my 4-star review over on the website right now. And lastly, I want to talk to you about Knuckles. So you already have seen a little snippet of James talking to series lead Adam Pally, who plays Wade Whipples. But I want to give you my quick thoughts on this 6-episode series, which also stars Idris Elba, Jamie Barbacoff, Alice Wren Trigoning, Tony Coughlan, Ben Schwartz, Daniel Singh, Colleen O'Shaughnessy, Alfredo Tavares, Adam Kerr. This is a very random cast list. Anya Thorley, Brian Jensen, Pierre Woodward, Carrie Elles, Christopher Lloyd, Edie Patterson, Rory McCann, Stockard Channing. Where's Ellie Taylor? Where's Kid Cudi? This is a strange cast list. IMDb. There's also Stockard Channing, Tika Sumter, Kid Cudi, Julian Barrett, Rob Hubel, Paul Scheer, and Ellie Taylor. Yeah, there they are. So it's a six-episode series, which is coming to Paramount Plus in the UK this Saturday, which is April the 27th. It is fun for all the family. So at the point that I am recording this, I have seen 4 of 6 episodes. I have now got the last 2. James has seen all 6, so if you want to read his full review of the whole season, it's up now on the website. Spoiler alert, but he gives it, he says as he scrolls, he gives it 4 stars and says, Knuckles is a great little show that doesn't take itself seriously whatsoever. It knows what it wants to do, and it executes it brilliantly. Fun, warming, and silly, this series is a wonderful expansion of Knuckles, who is at his utter best, as well as the well-deserved opportunity for Green Hill's best police officer, Wade Whipples. This may be Knuckles' show, but it's Wade that shines most. Everyone needs their own Wade Whipple. It's true, they do. So I don't want to add too much more other than to say that from my perspective, I think this is a really fun film that you're going to want to sit down and watch with all the family, series even, that you're going to want to sit down and watch with all the family. You get all 6 episodes in one go, so you can sit and binge. They're all around half hour episodes each, or you know, you can watch it one at a time, take breaks from it, watch a couple, come back and watch a few more. It's nice that you have that option, and it'll be interesting to see what kids want to do when they start watching it. There are a couple pitfalls. Firstly, this is actually very, very much Adam Pally's show. Wade Whipples is really the main character. Although Knuckles is the name on the banner, due to kind of just the budget, because obviously he's a CGI character. Knuckles isn't on screen for every second of every episode. In fact, at episode 4, he is almost entirely missing. He's at the beginning and end of that episode, but the rest focuses directly on Wade. So really, I think it should almost be called Wade and Knuckles, or Knuckles and Wade Show. It's very much a dual hander between the two of them. Their story is experienced together. The adventure that they go on is very much tied between the two characters, both going on their own particular personal journeys. But what I think is really, really fun is Adam Pally brings out the humour in Knuckles and Idris Elba, and it feels like Idris is having more fun playing the character here, because he's not just playing him straight up as a... I mean, he wasn't a villain in Sonic 2, but he, to begin with, was very much not on the same side as Sonic, and now he's getting to play him with a little more nuance and a little more fun, and that's really, really exciting to see. The show is very heavily serialised, but does have its elements of a plot to each episode. So again, if you're sitting and binging with the family, it will work, whereas you can take breaks and you can stop if the kids are kind of getting tired and want to watch something else for a little while or the attention span's waning. I want everyone to pay very close attention to episode 4 because it is flipping genius. It took this program to places I never expected it to go, and some of that is down to the fact that it has the absolutely incredible Julian Barrett as a supporting player. His character... it's hilarious in the first episode, and then kind of disappears for a while and then comes back. And when he comes back, my God, did they make good use of it. I mean, when you have Julian Barrett, it really should go to a place like this, and I'm glad that they did. No one will see it coming, and it's magical to watch. It's really magical to watch. But kind of down to the important parts, and this is the kind of thing that friends who've got kids will ask me, you know, does it look good? Yes, it does. Is the CGI good? Yes, it is exactly on par with both of the Sonic movies. Knuckles looks amazing. He's very well integrated into the world. Characters are able to integrate with him. And there's no kind of like weird eye lines. All of that stuff that you get when kids kind of notice that things aren't very well made. It's equally as well produced as the Sonic movies. And that's really, really nice to see. And I'm glad that Paramount gave it the budget that it needed to be able to do what they are able to do in the episodes that I have seen. There's a nice story. Again, because this is a family show, there is a kind of message there for Whipples? For Wade. It's about him kind of learning his place in the world and his place in the family, be that the family with Sonic and Knuckles and the characters in Green Hills, or also with his own family who make appearances as well. And for Knuckles, it's about learning, similarly really, it's about learning his place in the world, where he fits, you know, with Sonic and Tails and with the family, and what he is able to do with the world around him, and him kind of almost learning how humans and Earth work in a way that Sonic did in the first film, but just over a protracted kind of 6-episode story, which allows it to have a little bit more heart and a little bit more time to develop. And that's kind of the thing with a show that you get over a movie, rather than being 2 hours of, we need to introduce characters, need to get from A to B, we have this villain, you know, we have to do all of these things. Though there are villains in the show, that's not what it's about. It's about the journey, and it's about the character journey for both Wade and Knuckles, and that's what really shines through in the 4 episodes that I have seen. And James tells me, you know, shine through equally well in the last couple of episodes as well. I don't know how much it's going to tie into Sonic 3. I think it's very much its own thing that's set between the two, so don't expect massive kind of connections to the movies. Yes, I did say Ben Schwartz is in it, so you will get to see Sonic at the very beginning. Kids will love that it has that connection there, and that helps it to feel in the world of those movies, so you don't feel like you need to pick up a whole new kind of world and a new set of characters and learn all new things. You will understand the kind of language of the characters, the world that they're in, right from the get-go, and that's kind of perfect for kids who've enjoyed the movies to come straight into this without there being any kind of complex learning going on at the beginning. So you can just kick back, pop some popcorn, and enjoy and watch for all the family. So what more do I need to say? I think I would agree with James. I would give it 4 stars as well, and I'm very, very excited for people to watch it when it comes to Paramount Plus on Saturday the 27th of April. So please watch it and let me know what you thought. If you've got kids, I really want to know what kids think. I was sat next to a couple of families at the screening, and the kids really, really enjoyed it, and that's saying something, because the screening was on a Tuesday evening and it was kind of rattling on to like 9 o'clock, so some of the young kids were really tired, but they were still absolutely loving the show. So I'm hoping that works when it gets out to a wider audience as well. Knuckles, Paramount Plus, 27th of April, go watch it. And that is everything that I have to say for this episode. It's great to be back on YouTube. I'm waving to those of you who are watching this on video. Thank you for tuning in. Again, if you want to reach out and get in touch with any topics that you want me to cover on future episodes of the podcast, comments that you want to get involved with in the news, or things that you want to review, you want me to review and you want to comment on, then please find me on social media at Neil Vag on all major platforms, or find us at Get Your Comic On. In the meantime, for all the latest news and headlines, head over to our website, which is www.getyourcomiccon.co.uk. Have you figured out how many times I've said it? Maybe we should start like a drinking game that goes with it. And until next time, stay safe, stay well, and I will see you out there in the interwebs. Bye!